very excited to be joined by Trevor Baptiste, fresh off of the PLL Championship Series, and once again gracing the cover of Inside Lacrosse, this time elbow-to-elbow with 12 other PLL Black lacrosse players, sharing a message that is important for all to hear. And I wanted to talk to Trevor today because when considered amongst his peers, he had a take that I found to be particularly compelling. But before we get into that, Trevor, first of all, how are you doing? How are you holding up? How are you recovering?
I'm doing well. And Terry, obviously, it's great to talk to you as always. And thanks for having me on this. I'm getting back from the championship series. It's a lot of lacrosse in a short period of time. So I was able to take a week off or so, but now I'm starting to really, get back in the gym, get back to PT with just some injuries that suffered over in the bubble. But I'm feeling good, man. I'm feeling good. How about yourself? How you doing?
Hey, man. It's, lacrosse was played. Now we're in a little bit of a downtime. So that, feels like the soul needs to be fed. And I'm just trying to figure out what comes next. I think a lot of us are in that boat. There's so much uncertainty in this moment. There's certainly, I think, a growing sense of optimism that, hopefully the worst is behind us from a COVID-19 standpoint, and we can get back to some measure of congregating and playing. But until that day fully returns, we're just putting one foot in front of the other, right?
Right, exactly. Now, I think you're exactly right. And a lot of things are up in the air. A lot of things are up in the air in the world, so it's definitely tough knowing what the next move is going to be, and seeing hopefully lacrosse gets going here, for especially on the college front. That'd be great to see. But you see, obviously you want to be safe and everything like that.
No doubt. Well, so we will talk a little bit about the championship series and what that experience was like, but I wanted to start by talking about the cover of this issue of Inside Lacrosse magazine. It's the September issue, and for those of you that haven't seen it yet, Trevor is standing alongside Kyle Harrison, and I'm gonna list off all the players who are depicted here. We have Pat Harbison, Tyler Warner, Dominique Alexander, Romar Dennis, Brent Adams, Mark McNeil, Josh Byrne, Miles Jones, Tyson Bell, Dane Smith, and then we'll get to this in a second, but Jules Henningberg was represented there as well. You are wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts. First and foremost, can you describe the feeling that you felt taking this photograph on the field at Zions Bank Stadium in Harriman, Utah?
I guess to answer your question, I'll start out by saying that that group of Black lacrosse players, we've kind of all have come together, and we've done a lot of Zoom meetings and starting a Black Lacrosse Alliance, and we've really opened a lot of communication to each other, and just talking about different things that we've experienced or different ways that we can help the game grow and diversify the game. And hopefully the world, into some retrospect, to continue to educate and just speak on our experiences. And so taking that picture was kind of like, it was a really sweet moment, because we've been having all these conversations, every week, and finally being there together with everybody and kind of all coming together for this one picture. It was really sweet. It was cool.
So the cover text says taking a stand, and that speaks for itself. The notion that this is a movement, not a moment. One kind of element that you just touched on, I thought was well put by Romar Dennis, who said this is a niche within a niche. And I think that there's a lot of interest, a lot of intrigue, and a lot of truth to that. But one of the things that really struck out about what you chose and how you chose to express, your thought as far as being included in this photo is, you said, "I'd be remiss if I didn't speak to our goal to bring inclusion and acceptance to all players in lacrosse and to not condone violence or unlawful acts. There has been so much controversy over the term Black Lives Matter, and to us it just means those three words. It's not Black Lives Are Better or Burn Down the Nation. It's just the idea of acceptance and judging people for their character and not what they look like or what three words they do or don't hashtag. The only organization here is Black Lacrosse Alliance. And for me, that was a really important message to be told, because first and foremost, you look at the comments underneath any of these posts, you're going to see folks that view this issue differently and try to create a, for lack of a better word, opponent or a villain in the organization that falls underneath the banner of Black Lives Matter. But I share your point of view, which is that when you make a statement, you get to, you know, within certain reasons, like the dictionary, choose what that statement is. And so I felt like your decision to make that clear and explicit was really important and valuable. Can you just go into a little bit more detail on what motivated you to include that with the photo when you posted it on Instagram last week?
Yeah. You know, I'm really happy you brought that up. And, you know, for me and this whole experience of, you know, racial inequality is something that I've obviously lived, you know, in my own life, but, presently it's creating these sides, like you said, and like you said, like an opponent. A lot of that is been revolved around the words Black Lives Matter. And really what's happening is when you say Black Lives Matter, there's a narrative that you're saying something completely different than just Black Lives Matter, you know? And I think that's really important to say. And I think that was what we're all really trying to say, is that that's all we're saying, you know? And there's this narrative that if you say Black Lives Matter, you don't like police officers. Or if you say Black Lives Matter, you're a communist, you know, or something like that. And, you know, take it from someone who, I have family members who are police officers. All the guys in those groups are very close to police officers. I've been assaulted by a police officer for doing nothing. I still have the utmost respect for police officers, you know, and what they do. And I haven't taken my experience with one individual and paint that brush across the whole police force. And I think that's what people are getting all caught up in. And to me, it's unfortunate, because this is a moment where we can really strike change and like really look at these issues and really talk about them. But things are getting chalked up to, you know, communism, like defunding the police, and really politics. And Black Lives Matter, those three words, doesn't mean any of that. You know, if you look those three words up in a dictionary, those aren't connected at all. And that's what's made it extremely controversial. And that's what's made it extremely hard for people to get behind racial justice, you know, is because of those ideas. And I thought it would be important to just come forward and say, you can say Black Lives Matter and not be a communist, you know, like, or you can say Black Lives Matter and not think that you want to defund the police, you know, because Black lives do matter. And so do white lives. And so do Chinese lives. So does Hispanic and Latino lives. All lives matter, but there's an issue in this world and in this country specifically that needs to be addressed, you know? So that's why it's specific to Black and obviously Native Americans and all people. All their lives matter, but that's not the per se issue at hand. That's not the systemic issue that this country is facing.
And to me, I mean, I think I look at it and I see a lot of, you know, parts that are kind of just beneath the surface in that point that you just made. I mean, first and foremost, like, I don't think that you should have to qualify your comments to say, by saying this, I don't mean this, right? Like, and I understand, I'm not naive enough to think that, like, that isn't a part of every dialogue. But to me, like, what's disappointing, particularly in the context of this photograph, is, you know, you've got we're a lacrosse magazine, and you've got these 13 guys who have reached the pinnacle of their profession, and the audience, by and large, very acutely understands the role that being black has played in your experience within the sport. And so for readers of Inside Lacrosse, you know, our fans, people who, you know, have ascribed credibility to our brand and our publication, to then say, like, all right, well, I understand what those players have accomplished, but at the same time, like, they don't quite have enough credibility for me to take what they're saying at face value. That's what was so disappointing to me. It's like, until, you know, and it's not even until, there are people who respond to your comment saying you don't have the right to say what you mean or to decide what you mean. And for me, like, that's just, it's not pouring salt on a wound, but, you know, it's doubling down on exactly what the problem is here.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think you really hit that. And in my perspective, like, I don't expect everybody to be Martin Luther King, you know, and I don't expect myself to be that. I don't expect another black person, white person, anybody to be that, you know, but what I think is important is that, and this is what I kind of wrote in the actual write-up in the article, as you know, is that we're all humans, you know, we're all human and we're all people and we're all the same species, you know? So there is, people should be at least aware or sensitive to the fact that there's a big systemic issue, you know, and what's happening is, people may realize that, but they don't want it to come above anything else. You know, they want it to, there are other priorities that come above that for them. You know, it doesn't mean that they don't care. And some people just don't care about it, you know, but a lot of people do care, but they feel a priority to show that if they say Black Lives Matter, then all of a sudden they're not patriotic anymore. And they feel this responsibility to be a proud American, you know, and realistically those two things really shouldn't even be conflicting. You know, if America really is what it is and it is what everybody says it is and why we are proud to be in this country, those things shouldn't conflict, you know? And it's a humanitarian conversation, not anything else, in my opinion.
I think that's really well said, and I'm going to attempt to make a kind of awkward but hopefully funny transition. What the two points that you just made are laced with positivity. And so, I think it was fantastic that the, I don't know, probably most substantial conversation that I saw in the comments surrounding this photo was, it did not escape anybody's notice that pretty much everybody else is mean mugging except for Trevor. Trevor's got a smile on his face and we got to talk about that. So you took a little bit of shade from some of your fellow cover subjects. How do you defend yourself when it comes to your inability to do anything other than smile?
I mean, that's just it, man. You said it. When I saw the picture, I thought I wasn't smiling. I really thought I wasn't smiling. Like, I was trying very hard to not smile. And I really thought I wasn't smiling. But it could have been, you know, obviously they took a bunch of pictures. So, you know, like, you know, a couple guys cracking jokes here.
Yeah,
and there,
we're not seeing teeth here. So I will say that this is not the, you know, kind of the Trevor Baptiste ear-to-ear grin that everybody is familiar with. This was just a little bit more, you know, ends of lips curled up as opposed to looking like you're ready to go bar down.
Right. Yeah. And you know, like, I'm sure maybe somebody said something funny or something like that. And, like, I was still kind of chuckling over it because I always, like, because I laugh at everything for an amount of time. So, like, I was probably, like, still smiling about it. And I was trying to get my straight face back on or something like that. But, yeah, you know, like, I kind of felt bad. Like, when I saw the picture, I was like, oh, dang, you know, like, I really should have been more serious, you know. But I am serious, you know. And to me, I think you can be serious with a smile on your face, you know, just because you're happy doesn't mean you can't be doesn't mean you're not serious, you know? And yeah, you know, but no, I took some heat, but I, to tell you the truth, I really thought I wasn't smiling. I really honestly thought I wasn't smiling. And then for the individual pictures, what everybody will see later, I'm like straight up dying laughing or something. Like I have this huge smile on my face for the individual pictures in the article. But I just remember I was like, Sammy was taking pictures and we were just laughing about something.
Were you laughing by any chance?
The best picture of the bunch.
Were you by any chance laughing about Unreal Flow? Because I feel, or perhaps Kyle's checkered sneakers size 18, as it was well noted by those that checked out the photo. And that's a perspective issue. That being said, because those are the other two features that absolutely stand out. Can we start by getting a comment on Tyson Bell's hair?
Yeah, I mean Unreal Flow. I mean he's living up to the reputation. I mean that's it. But no, I wasn't laughing about that. Or the shoes. You know, it was just like I said, like the 12 of us. We've been talking for so long, and in those Zoom calls and everything like that, that we felt like when we were all together, it was. We've become so close, you know, like we've had really real conversations. So when I'm with people that I'm close with or that I care about, you know, I can't help but smile, you know, I can't help it.
So the last question that I've got about the photo is Jules Henningberg was unfortunately still recovering from COVID-19 and had some health complications that prevented him from being able to participate in the championship series. And so as a result, he wasn't on hand for this photo. So we had to Photoshop him in. How do you feel about the job that my man Matt Cain, creative director at Inside Lacrosse, did?
I think you did a good job. I mean, obviously I'm gonna like, I think everybody that was in the picture is like, oh, you know, like that was Photoshopped in cause we know it. But, no, I think you did a really great job. Like, I like really impressive work. And also, I think the raw footage was going around, on some accounts. Like I got tagged in it or somewhere. And people were actually saying, why isn't Jules in this picture? Where's Jules? So that's just a testament of great Photoshop work because they thought he was actually there, you know?
Totally. So let's shift gears and talk about what life inside the bubble was like. I've talked to a bunch of guys. It's been described a bunch of different ways. Where do you come down on the spectrum of like Spartan, you know, deathmatch through like high school lacrosse fantasy camp? Where did the experience fall for you?
Ooh. I don't know where on that scale it would be, but I'll say this. The championship series was, first of all, I got to shout out, you know, the PLL staff in terms of the medical staff and Dr. Logan and Mike Junta and everybody doing operations. They did such a phenomenal job of not only making sure we're all safe from COVID-19, but making sure that everything was extremely accommodable. You know, the whole time I was there, I had everything that I needed, whether that was from the training aspect, you know, food, water, you know, entertainment. And I mean, you're with 22 other guys, so we should be pretty entertained as it is, you know? But they did such a great job with that. And in the on field, you know, it was a lot of lacrosse. It was a lot of lacrosse in a short period of time. And you talk about 4 days of training camp, which consisted of 2 days, most days, basically all the days was 2 days, getting ready and then playing those games, two games back to back and then having only 24 hours to recover, most days. It was a lot, you know, and you get beat up. And even for myself, like, I was kind of band-aiding some stuff, through those 2 weeks. But in terms of like the competitiveness, I thought it was still all right there. You know, like everybody was in every game. It felt like everybody was really excited to be out there. And I think that's natural because we saw a world where we couldn't play anymore. You know, we saw that and not knowing when's the opportunity to play again. So I think everybody was really excited and nobody was trying to take that for granted.
I think I can make an argument that there is no position where the transition from college to pro is greater than at the Faceoff X. Similar to goalies, you have a equivalent winnowing down of the talent pool when, you know, pretty much one guy gets on the field. But, differently, you know, goalies aren't competing against one another. Goalies are competing against shooters. So you take, you know, face-off guy in college, and if you're playing at the Division One level, you're, you know, the spectrum of talent goes from 1 to roughly 75, or really probably more like 130, because most teams are going to use a couple of face-off guys. And now you're, you know, basically facing off against 7 or 8 other players. What is it like to make that transition, and how much harder is the position at the pro level than it is at the college level as a result?
I think you really hit that. And face-offs specifically, there's nothing like going into a summer game and taking like 32 face-offs against the same guy who's had a ton of success, just as much success as you have. And doing that week in and week out, you know, it's extremely hard, and it's a very physical position. And I would say that where the level really increases is the speed of the game and how great everybody is in the open field. So in college, you know, especially at the Division I level, everybody is extremely talented as well. But in the pros, it's everyone's best player going for a ground ball, you know? So not only is it a battle at the X per se, but you know, those loose balls, you got guys that were the guys that you kept the ball away from in college, you know, and now you just can't do it. You know,
totally.
There's no place to keep the ball away from them, you know, cause you either go left and then you're battling against a long pole who's amazing, or you go right, you're going against a short stick who's amazing, you know? So I'd say that would be the biggest jump of how everyone's so great in the open field and how they could pick up the ball and make fast and sound decisions. As opposed to college, you know, it's a little bit, obviously the skill's lower, but guys play roles, you know? So, you know, someone might pick up a ground ball and then they're trying to get the ball into somebody else's hands, you know, for them to carry the ball. But the pros, everybody can carry the ball. Everybody's a threat. Everybody can push transition, which is tough. It's dangerous, you know?
What's it like mentally adjusting from a good game in college being, say, winning 75% and picking up 11 or 13 ground balls and producing a point to a good game in the pros being going 54% and picking up 5 ground balls, but winning like the 2 or 3 most important faceoffs? Let me first ask, is that an accurate description of the differences between a good game at each level? And if so, what's that transition like?
I would agree. You know, I think, I think you're right. You're right on that. And I feel like just coming into the pros, you just got to know that the margin of error is a lot lower, you know? So whether it's a false step or you're throwing that ball out maybe 5 yards further than you should have, or, you know, you don't take the most efficient way to the ground ball, a lot of times that you're going to pay for that, you know? So because that margin of error is so low, you just got to know going in that everybody's really good and you're not going to go 75% every game, you know? It's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. But that doesn't mean that you can't have victories within your game or victories within your mind. Like you said, those big face-offs of the game, or scoring a point, or even, you know, causing mismatches, you know, maybe you win a faceoff and keeping their draw guy on, maybe like a first line midi or something like that. That's another big win. And something that usually correlates to a goal or a great look. So there's a lot of other areas in the game that you can pinpoint success as well.
So presumably you're in between the PLL Championship Series and the beginning of the 2021 NLL season. What has now being a multi-season professional lacrosse player, what's that transition been like? And then separately, how has playing box, playing indoor influenced your outdoor game? And I know you did it in college, but I'm talking about at the professional level.
Yeah. You know, I think, I guess to answer your first question of being that full-time indoor outdoor and now getting a couple seasons, two seasons under my belt, I'd say the biggest challenge when I started out was, knowing when you're good, knowing what you have to do to be ready to go and play. Because in college, you know, you have practice 6 days a week. You're living with all the guys that you're playing with, and you got a strength and conditioning staff, you got a training staff, and you got all these people that are with you every day that are around the block from you every day. So, I don't want to say you're a baby to an extent, but you have a lot of people that, tell you what you need to do, you know, and when you get to the pros, in the way pro lacrosse is formatted, you know, kind of Monday through Thursday, you're kind of out on your own a little bit, and you got to know what you need to do to be ready to go on Saturday. And finding that routine or finding that comfort in whatever you're doing. And that was tough for me, when I started out, you know, I think I started out, maybe I was overdoing it a little bit too much. And then I was underdoing it. And then I realized that, there's a lot of parts of the game that I wasn't really drilling, practicing, that you just do in practice at college when I was at DU that I kind of didn't even realize, you know? So I'd say that was probably the toughest part. And then aside of that is just, there's so much lacrosse in a year that you get pretty beat up, you know? So you get dinged up playing, you know, almost 10 months out of the year, which is a lot to be in season in any sport, you know? And to not have, a big sizable off season to recover,
How has being an indoor player and an indoor draw taker influenced your outdoor game?
Right. Yeah. Sorry. I just got lost in my thoughts for a second. Yeah. So playing indoor is been tremendous for my game. I feel like it helps so much. I recommend playing indoor to anybody, any position. Such a fun game. And I had great organization with the Wings, and they've done a lot for me, and giving me a shot to play was huge. But I would say, one, the fact that although you're getting beat up and you're playing a lot of lacrosse, you're staying sharp, you know? So kind of going back to that idea of you're not practicing every day, 6 days a week. You're getting five more months of playing in a year. So that's going to translate to outdoor. And then also more specifically to the gameplay, just picking up balls and loose balls and making passes under pressure and in tight spaces is I'd say in indoors to the extreme. You know, you have, if you're talking face-off specific, you have four guys instead of two running in on you now, and they're all closer. You know, they're all 10 yards away from you, you know, just about. So you got to be able to get that ball up, out into space, and to relieve that pressure on yourself.
It's, it certainly seems like the, you know, when people talk about the merits and assets of playing indoor lacrosse and how it makes you better as a field player. You know, typically the increased frequency of touches by virtue of the fact that there are fewer players on the floor and the ball doesn't go out of bounds and it goes from one end to the other more frequently than it does in field lacrosse. Like, all of those reasons are the reasons that, you know, guys play more and it or get better faster is what I meant to say. And it feels like it's not exactly the same in at the faceoff position, but it is similar. And so, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that, particularly when it comes to, you know, there's no substitute for the pressure of a live game. The last question that I wanted to ask is about the proposed and now likely to occur rule changes in college lacrosse that essentially outlaws the knee down double overhand modal grip posture and instead replaces it with the standing neutral grip. Generally speaking, what are your thoughts? Are you in favor of this? Are you opposed to it? Do you feel like it was something that you would have benefited from, something that would have injured your game? And if you were in a position where you had to adjust, how would you have attacked making this adjustment?
Yeah. I think obviously the rule change was huge news, and it put a lot of youth players, high school players, college players on notice, and they were very, very vocal about what they thought and what they thought about the rules. In my opinion, I feel like I understand what the rules committee is trying to do in terms of speeding up the game and speeding up the face-off. In my opinion, and to prevent lockups. In my opinion, I do feel like there were other alternatives that they could have looked into to get the same results, but they went with standing neutral grip, you know? So that's what they went with. I'm not on the rules committee, so to some extent, I don't even know if it matters what I think, but what I will say is I think it's going to be cool. I've obviously done a lot of coaching and I still think guys are going to be better at it than some guys. I still think there's going to be dominant face-off guys. I do think that some players have maybe a better skill set that this type of face-off might improve their game more so than somebody else's. But in my opinion, I do feel like the players that have the most success in college have basically all the skill sets you need to have success in standing neutral grip facing off, you know, and that's being able to have great footwork after the face off, you know, have a great acceleration, being able to pick up ground balls, being able to move the ball. You know, if you look at all the top face off guys that have ever played in college, they were all able to do that. You know, and they were all able to do that extremely well. And those were the things that made them better than a lot of other players, you know? So I think adding this stand-up fashion, I don't think it's going to change too much in who's great. I think there's a lot of guys that maybe were average and maybe they're going to be towards the top now, but I don't think the guys that were on the top are going to slow down too much. You know, I think they're going to stay at the top.
One quick follow-up on that. What is the relative value of winning the clamp in the traditional moto grip style versus standing neutral grip? How much less valuable is it to win the clamp in standing neutral grip?
That's a great point. So you're exactly right. It is less valuable. Is there still value to it? Yes, absolutely. But there's definitely less value because of the idea that the guy that you're going against is already on his feet. So usually if you're both knee down and you control the clamp, then you kind of get a head start to the ball. You know what I'm saying? And you kind of, you take more control over the situation. When you're standing neutral grip, if you control that clamp, it basically takes away the time where your opponent has to get to his feet to try to counter you or to get in your way or to contend the ground ball, you know? So it does take that advantage away. And also with standing neutral grip, bottom rail moves are going to be a lot more popular. So, you know, raking is going to be a very viable move. And a lot of guys are going to be great at it because you'll be able to get underneath someone's clamp. And if you just dislodge the ball a little bit, then I'm on my feet and you're still looking down on the ground, you know? So I don't have to get up off my knee after I rig, you know? So I think, you know, rigging is going to be big too. But it's going to be interesting. I also, like, I guess I would say my one counter to the whole process of the rule changes, I know that they do want the face-off to become more of a 3-on-3 battle. That was a big point that they did want to make. And I think everybody's got to understand, like, the faster the ball gets out, the less of a 3-on-3 battle it's going to be, because the guys actually won't have time to get to the ball, you know? So I thought maybe bringing the wings in would be a better alternative to that, rather than keeping the wings where they are and then trying to get the ball out faster, because then it's still going to turn into a 1-on-1, and even almost more so, because, you know, the guys aren't even going to have time to get in there. So those two things kind of contradict each other.
The last question I have on this topic is about you mentioned control, the amount of control that you're able to exhibit over the ball when you rake in the traditional underhand grip versus the double overhand grip, and how important that is relative to it. Basically, my assumption is that, like, it's just harder because you're not really pinching the ball, I don't think, to the same extent that you are in moto grip. And when the ball is pinched, your ability to place where it's supposed to go is higher compared to when you're clamping and pulling the ball out in underhand rake. Is that right?
I think to an extent, yeah. Like, I do believe that, you know, if you get a good clamp and a great plunge on the ball, neutral grip, you'll be able to put the ball wherever you want it, you know? I think it's going to be harder with the fact that the guy in front of you is standing up, so he's going to just be pestering you a lot, you know? So you're not going to have a lot of time to do that. But I think you can. Obviously, with a rake, standing neutral grip, you're trying to get control of the face-off by taking the control away from your opponent. That's a good way to put it. So you're not really trying to control the ball in that way. But to your point, yes, you know, when you're standing and you're crouched down, it's not really about, like, getting your fist and knuckles to the ground. You know, it's not really about driving that top sidewall rail over the ball. It's more about trying to grab it, you know, trying to grab it quickly and get the ball out. And that's what they want, right? They want the ball to get out fast. So that's why I think the fact that they did go this route does make sense for what they were trying to do. You know, I think it makes sense, but I think there could have been a lot of different ways to do it, you know, but I think it makes sense for what they're trying to accomplish.
Right on. Well, Trevor Baptiste, we started in one place and ended in another. As always, it's been great to catch up with you. We look forward to watching you on a lacrosse field wherever and whenever that may be. And in the meantime, wish you the best of luck as you continue to both get healthy and get in the kind of shape you're looking to, as well as continue to advance this very important conversation happening within the sport of lacrosse and beyond.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Terry. And as always, thank you. It's great to talk to you. And appreciate you guys even making this whole issue, you know, the Inside Lacrosse September issue. Like, that was putting us on the cover and bringing awareness that's really important. And I appreciate it, and we all do.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you saying that. We'll talk to you again soon.